You are listening to the Next Best Picture podcast, and this is Will Mavity's interview with the cinematographer for Radioactive, Anthony Dodd-Mantle.
I read your paper. It contains some exceptional science.
My instinct is that there is another element.
You think you found an undiscovered element?
Science is changing, and the very people who are running science believe the world was flat.
Leave my laboratory.
If my science doesn't speak for itself, then you have gravely misunderstood it.
I'm going to prove them wrong.
We all thought that atoms were finite and stable. Well, some of them are not. I have called this radioactivity. Our discovery could cure cancer.
Extraordinary. You changed the world. Our work's been nominated for the Nobel Prize. The commendation only mentions my name.
You stole my brilliance. How dare you take their applause?
This is bigger than both of us.
I just wanted to do good science.
There are those that say that radium is making them sick.
The question can be raised whether mankind benefits from knowing the secrets of nature.
I have been haunted my entire life trying to understand the impossible. This is my fight. And I will win it.
It's been a confusing week because we've got Cameron Marsh, so I've been trying to talk about another film that we've been quite hard to do. That was like a year and a half ago, and now we're on Radioactive, so I have to start sort of, you know, waking up the dead.
Well, what are you going to be working on next, also? Are you shooting right now?
I shot a very small anarchic independent feature in London under lockdown for a very small budget about predators, sexual predators called Victims, which would be very interesting. And I've been doing a couple of commercials, and I've gone straight into a 6-7 month, 8 month job with Danny Boyle now, which I start up, which is difficult because of COVID, you know, traveling back and forth. But we're basically in London, you know, short of the longs. We're doing a massive thing about the Pistols, Sex Pistols. Should be great fun, I think.
Oh, okay. Well, obviously, I and everyone, including the Academy, loves your collaborations with Danny Boyle. Well, that's nice. That's very exciting.
We've had fun together.
So yeah, Radioactive is an interesting film visually, and it's you had some fun with it because it's something that could have been really stuffy to look at.
You can be really honest with me, Will. You must be really honest with me because you checked out my TV. It's probably 40 or 50 films. Never as a film, you know, all films are weird beasts in their own right, but never as a film puzzled me more than this, because I'm aware of its kind of arrogance and, you know, conceit as a sort of independent, a bit arty film, but I just felt it was such a strong piece in its own little world, completely in its own world, and I was really, really pleased actually about my visual collaboration with Marjan, who I love dearly. You know, she's mad as a hatter, but adorable and no fool. And, you know, to support, number one, a woman, well, just a great filmmaker, but luckily enough, a female, you know, director from a very strange background who's pushing the envelope in different ways. I kind of really came out of it trying to be objective, but aware that it was a little bit dodgy in places, but I thought it was kind of great. And never will, but I'll be really honest with you, never have I met, and I'm not fishing for your comments, flattery or critique, but I've never felt more, partly because of the lockdown and the silence around about the premiere. Any other film, you meet in so much strange silence. Which I know it means some people don't necessarily not like it, but don't quite understand it or don't turn on to it. And I know it's good visually, I know it's interesting, I know it's different. And I know Marjan is telling something really difficult about a very complicated subject. You know, Dear Rosamunda is really good, but it's not coming across. So maybe we just got chopped at a really critical time, you know, with COVID. I don't know what it is, but I'm just being honest with you. So that's where I'm at with it. I love it dearly, and I'm proud of it. And we can talk to the cast and I'll ask you whatever you want, and I'll be honest. But that's how I feel about it. It's a strange reception.
Yeah, I think especially kind of in that it came out in that early period of COVID. I think that's exactly it. There was a bunch of content like Tiger King that people are getting caught up with, and it kind of got lost in the shuffle. But
yeah,
I was pleasantly surprised, I think, when I saw it. And I think obviously that's in no small part to what you did to it visually. There's some interesting specific aspects about the film that make it stand out. There's a big sequence in the middle of the film where Marie Curie's husband passes and she has this kind of surreal hallucination sequence. And that's one of the big moments in the film. I was curious kind of you would tell me a little bit about what went to, you know what I'm talking about, where she's surrounded by the dancers.
Yeah, that's where people wake up. that's where people wake up and, hey, bums on seats. Separate, safe distance, social distancing, bums on seats. No, I know what you mean, yeah. It comes after quite a long, sequence from start of the film where there's a suggestion that the film is going to be kind of a little bit unusual visually, but in fact it's quite Slavic in its approach to presenting character and the history of the relationship between them, before he dies and up to his death, and the ambition and the establishing of the lab and all the sort of, the tasks she had to prove to the very male audience around her that she was capable of scientists. That kind of is probably going on for about 25 minutes, I guess, until this guy goes and kicks the bucket and gets run over by a horse. And then it does, that gets you emotionally, basically, Will. It's not a tactic. It's just what happens. So suddenly people realize that one of the main characters that you're just beginning to enjoy just gets killed. And she gets thrown into this kind of delirium, which is a visual delirium. And it is a kind of style, not break, but it's a development in the film that takes you into another abstract land. And I know this film's gone back and forth and cutting, and maybe it comes as a shock. It is a sequence that is about the inside of her brain as much as, a biopic can do that. And it's about loss, and it's about fear, and it's about the dynamics of chemistry and our helplessness in a physical world where we just, arrive as a baby and die as an old person, and, we become atoms again, and eventually just, it's about atoms and our DNA. And so the film kind of goes into that weird journey of death and the funeral procession and the colour, which is associated very much with what her reason for living has been, experimenting and researching in those chemicals. And then, of course, it kills. And the accident, it wasn't the chemicals that killed her husband. It was just the fact that they were beginning to doubt and fear what they were in the process of creating and working with. And it's a warning, it's a foreboding warning of what is to come and her vulnerability as a human being. I guess that's me as a photographer speaking. And it was a joy to do. And I know it's been bounced around in the editing quite a lot. I know the editor has enjoyed it. You can feel he wakes up and really goes out of there, which is all beautiful. And a lot of it, most of it is in camera. It's lovely to do stuff like that. And I any cinema photographer rejoices in, trying to speak more in pictures and space and colour and light and less in words. And Marjan is a disciple of that. So that's the joy of working with him. It's just about getting the balance right, Will. But that's really what that sequence is about.
Well, so you mentioned a lot of the work is in camera there. So there were a few specifics I was curious about. Number one, tell me about the dancing woman whose dress is lit. Tell me a little bit about how you did that.
Yeah, she's amazing. I mean, basically, she's a historic figure who basically, I think, forgive me for being a little bit rusty about names, but I know you're talking about. And there's a scene quite early in the film where they're courting each other, and she's up on the stage, and there's this extreme, I find a really beautiful sequence, actually, where I kind of used the dancer as the key light, and I blasted three different color temperatures or four or five different color temperatures light directly onto her costume, which would then bounce back into the audience, into the darkness where the audience were watching. And that was in principle what she did. She basically danced in light and did these extraordinary rotating movements and was a real figure in real life. And what I wanted to do was and it wasn't necessarily planned in prep, but we decided as we got to shooting that we'd bring her back as a sort of, it's kind of a dance of death. So it's kind of, again, a sort of shamanic movie. But we decided to bring her back for that funeral sequence where she's backing away and, surrounded by this extraordinary figure, which I really adore, So she was an extraordinary real-life person. The woman is a dancer herself. I forget her name too, but she's beautiful. And it's based on a very, very true life performance by this Fuller, was her name. And she experimented with light and movement in a very, that incredible early period in the, you know, the early 1900s, where the car was being invented, the telephone was coming, people were beginning to dress more interesting, artists were exploding in excitement. You know, the whole world was like in a modernist period. You know, it was a fantastic time, I think, to live in, and also a very dangerous time to live in. And she was then just, you know, with all the science research, which I knew much less about, and Marjan introduced me to, you know, it was an interesting time. She's kind of a symbol of that, I guess. But she comes back to kind of envelope her, I guess, in her mourning, in that sequence as she walks back and the clock of the pages are. It's abstract. It's a kind of Greek tragedy almost, isn't it?
Yeah. I was also curious, I mean, there is some pretty interesting production design work going on here. There was one moment that stood out, and I was curious about your involvement here, which is, in terms of tragedy, right before Marie's husband is about to give his speech in Sweden, he's in a room surrounded by X's. And I know that's, you know, in classic visual storytelling, that's kind of the symbol of something bad's going to happen. Were you involved in the location scouting or the production design with some of the rooms like that?
Yeah, just remind me. She's surrounded by what? Just remind me again. It's in the space where, is it before she receives or before he receives?
It was before he's about to speak. And like, I know he goes out on stage, but in the room where they're like, are you ready? And he says, no, I'm not ready. And he's surrounded by X's on the wall. And I thought that was really interesting. It was just kind of a very dynamic way to stage that scene. I was curious if that was kind of your handiwork.
I mean, Michael Carlin is, I shot, my first experience with Michael Carlin in design was Last King of Scotland with Kevin MacDonald. And I did The Eagle in Scotland with him, with Channing Tatum and Jamie Bell, which was on film. That was also Michael Carlin. He's so amazing at going to a mad place and constructing some amazing world. So a lot of it is down to Michael. And, you know, we did quite a lot of camera together with him, and he's a clever guy. That is basically trying to enhance the whole stiffness of the Swedish world, and his developing nausea and his coughing blood, right? And he's about to go in there, and she's sitting with the man who will become her lover, in the laboratory, waiting, restless, and asking, if I remember rightly, what time it is in Europe, in Sweden, is that right?
Yes.
And they travel through the train. It's not the scene where she travels in the train, which I shot. It's the scene where he's waiting there, and he coughs blood, and the guy comes out and asks if he's ready. I mean, it's basically just design. It's really just looking for that stiff, still very, very male-dominant, male-governed world of the Nobel Prize. You know, it's really that. That's all we're looking for. So it's in colours and it's in textures. And I think when he goes out with the speech, I use some abstract lenses and kind of destroy the space around him a bit, because it's a sort of cerebral contact between him and Marie Curie, because they have this sort of bond of extraordinary contact, really, which is why it's so sad when they die.
Yeah, I was curious about
that.
They
were never really apart. That was our presumption. It was our assumption that we were never really apart until they died, and he still lived with her. And that was the idea, that way after he died, that he stayed with her and she felt him. And that's the conceit. And, depending on pretentious, but you just got to do these things when you make films and trust it. You know, you just got to do it and go for it. And the people who love it, love it. And the people that fall away, they probably fall away for some reason early in the film. And we lose some people on that. You know, but that's the conceit of it, if you get what I mean.
It's a beautiful love story. You mentioned that scene where he goes out to speak, and I don't know if you used a tilt shift there to kind of close in, but I saw you did that a few times in the film to kind of destroy the edges. I was curious a little bit about that effect that you use throughout the film.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book. And together, we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our ninth season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.
You've watched them in unforgettable adventures, love affairs, and tragedies. Now it's time to hear their own remarkable stories. From the makers of Death of a Rockstar and Death of a Sports Star, this is Death
Ready.
Of a Film Star.
And action.
Starring Heath Ledger, Marilyn Monroe, Chadwick Boseman, Robin Williams, Carrie Fisher, and Bruce Lee. Search for Death of a Film Star in your podcast app. You've seen them tell stories. Now it's time to tell theirs.
Yeah, I'm very naughty at destroying the edges. I'm not a well-behaved, well-brought-up boy when it comes to that. But I mean, I kind of know when I do it and why I do it, and I wish I could find some other tools. But I'm definitely trying to develop new ideas, because you see quite a lot of my work, and it rears its head. But there's usually a reason, and it's never the same reason. I was just talking earlier today in Camera Mage about The Undoing, which I shot with Nicole, and there's quite a lot of it in there, which is about the sort of, that's not what we're going to talk about now, but that's about the undermining violence behind these rich people in New York, and you know, the lies behind the truth of everything that Nicole is saying, or we don't know. So it's a, you know, that's the reason for me doing it in, I'm really breaking down the DNA of the truth of the film negative in The Undoing, and that was the idea for that. In Radioactive, it was more about, I don't know, it was more from a sort of physiochemical point of view, I think. I just write something. Sometimes I confess I'm in a difficult location where I do not fall in love with something I can't change. So I try and a little bit more discreet, just pull the actors a little bit out of that world without jolting the audience. In the case of Radioactive, it's mostly about enhancing an element of the picture that I really want the audience to feel, either a face or an emotion in a face, like an eye, like the speech, or like when she's making her speech and she's seen from the back, holding a hand up and asking the audience to be quiet. In fact, the reason I've got the camera is because in the scene shot, he was standing there as a ghost behind her. You know, he's always with her and guarding her. So that's one of the reasons that these kind of swing shifts come into play, because I'm usually using it with a plan to introduce something else. And then sometimes something happens in the editing, so it goes a bit crazy. But that's basically an already active. It's more of a physiochemical, hard to explain. Well, I wish I could really say exactly. I have to think about it. If I get a brilliant idea, I'll write it to you. Give me a minute. I'll look back at my notes. I'm sitting in my room. It's a complete chaos. I've got all my scripts, all my mini scripts, and I'm frantically looking to talk to you. Thank God I'm not on Zoom for my notes on Radioactive. I'm in lockdown. I'm stuck between England and Denmark, trying to service Danny Boyle and look after my family, and I don't know whether I'm going on Monday or Friday. I'm doing Camera Mage, which is all a jumble today. So I'm not completely as lucid as I sometimes can be for it.
Oh, don't worry.
If you feel you need this interview with a gaping hole and you want an answer, just note it down for me, and I'll revisit it.
Okay, well then let's talk about something that I think will immediately jump out to your memory, which is, tell me about some of those flash forward sequences, like the Chernobyl one and the Nevada nuke test site, because those are some of the big visual moments.
Yeah, I mean, they're there. I mean, when I read the scripts, it was like a poem. It read almost like a poem, and there are not many writers that do that or want to do that or dare to do that, and there are not many producers who dare to produce it. And it read even more like a poem when I read it. But, you know, and one of the main and first presumptions that we make of the audience is that they accept that we jump forward and back in time, which is in fact a fascinating talent that film does have. Because when you get people in the audience, especially a film in the cinema, people are set, they're paid and they sit there and they give themselves to you. And Danny Boyle is a prime example of this. He's more and more obsessed about, you know, sustaining of time and the upheaval of time and time slice and things like this, which we're exploring at the moment. And what Marjan wanted to do was obviously work with the connotations of, which is a classic cliche, you know, the ups and downs of Einstein, you know, the great you know, the great brilliance of a brain like Einstein, what he could create, and in the hands of the wrong people, as Pierre Curie says in his reception speech, you know, at the Nobel Prize Award, you know, in the hands of the wrong people, you know, it's fatal. And basically, it's a visual echo of those words that are in themselves enough, but it's beautiful to be asked by a director to illustrate that. So, you know, we thought, well, let's do that. Let's remind people in as poetic and as dramatic and as political way as possible. You know, Chernobyl existed. We went there. It's horrifying. I've walked Chernobyl. You know, Nagasaki, Hiroshima, we all know it's across the world what we're talking about. And the incredible things that have been done, you know, hand in hand with that, you know, for cancer research and saving people's lives. It's an eternal dilemma for human beings to accept that, like the H-bomb, you can get in the wrong hands, you can do as much damage as you can do good. And that's the reason for doing that. And it's just about trying to tap into that notion and that emotion at the right time in a linear narrative that is, in many ways, also, I wouldn't call it a biopic, but the audience are wanting to follow, you know, a historic, incredible figure, played very well, obviously, by Rosa Munda, but they're kind of jolted out of the linear time of film, you know, for that reason, to just trigger some kind of reaction, I think, in the audience. It's a poetic device that Marjane has no problem about utilizing, because she comes from graphic arts, you know, she's a very, very intelligent, emotional, and extraordinarily scientifically intelligent person, which surprised me. I thought she was lying, but you know, she could explain the periodic table to me. And I really thought, I don't believe you, woman. But I'm so incredibly stupid, and I have chemistry and physics. I was thrown out of class at the age of 13 for cheating. So she took pity on me. But that is her also playing with the, you know, the chemical language of cinema. I think that's what we're doing. Playing the logic. You know, and the destiny. And that's what film can do. You get it right.
Well, so one thing in one of those sequences, I noticed you, especially in recent years, I want to say recent, but I guess like Rush isn't that recent, but there's something you do with the sky. And I wasn't sure, you see it in the Nevada nuclear test site scene, and I saw it a lot in Rush. And I'm not sure if it's something you do in post or if it's something that you just do with like, with ND filters or something in camera, but do you know what I'm talking about? The sky looks very almost surreal.
I think something in my visual game, I've been thinking a little bit about this lately, because I'm the same. I stitch myself up quite often in sets as a cinematographer because I love ceilings. I'm not particularly interested in the grounds. I'm not particularly interested in the floor, but I'm really fascinated by ceilings. So I very often kill my first light source with my gaffer by saying, well, let's fill the ceiling in there and we'll find out another way of doing it. And I did that a lot on the last films I've done. And in the same way, the sky to me is a ceiling. And certainly in Radioactive, you know, skies, it's not space, it's not nothing, it's something. You know, it's atoms, you know. And I've become more and more absorbed by that, which is basically an intellectual thought. So, yes, when I shot, it really struck me that I got very aggressive about it when I was making *The Hound of the Sea*, actually, which was the film didn't do so well. It was the film I did for Warner's after.
Oh yeah, it looks great though.
Yeah, but what I do is I am quite brutal and blatant about what I want to do in camera, and I invariably stick my finger or a bit of my fringe, you know, or part of my sandwich in front of the lens if it does the job. I like to not knock the visuals about. Not as an anarchic idiot, but not with disrespect to our wonderful, you know, lens builders and, you know, manufacturers, but I like to get things happening in the lens in the moment. And I often put my fingers in front of the lens partially just to break it down. And in Rush, I was basically shooting most of Rush on a strip of asphalt about 150 yards long, 27 miles northwest of London. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not a particularly sexy space to make a film. And I actually, I must say, I love Rush, and I think we got a bit bummed. I think a lot of people on Rush worked very, very hard with very little money, and I think we made it look great. And I think we got punished because I think certain people behind Rush went for a big release and they got hit hard because they got greedy and it didn't work. I think if they released Rush as a real small umbrella release, I think a lot of us maybe have done a bit better, because I went from being a songwriter, went from being a talk of the town to being whitewashed. But on that film, I wanted to vary that 150 yards of asphalt from the Japanese Grand Prix to Monaco to the Brazilian. So I had to work really together with Post, but I did a lot. You know, when I get the weather and the weather comes, I go for it and I bring that sky down, because for me, it's feeling, it's real. And I very rarely, like in the Heart of the Sea, I very rarely let the skies pop unless I really want them to, and then they do pop. But I noticed when I was at sea a lot that there's very often an invisible overlay between the horizon, between the sea that you're being thrown around in, and the sky itself. And there are many painters, great painters, on your side of the pond who have painted beautiful seascapes, and Russian painters who've painted beautiful seascapes where there's no apparent horizon. So I started to get interested in this, and that happened in Rush, it happened in the Heart of the Sea, and I do it quite a lot. So I do use graduation filters, and I get special filters manufactured that help me with soft edges to bring the picture down. So from basically what I'm trying to do is fill the canvas of the frame a lot more with, not detail, but with tonal qualities. You understand what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I try to fill it in a way that painters work. But you never see painters on canvas, which I agree is a different medium, but you never see painters burning out the top third of the picture because it's real. And a lot of cinema, photography, so a lot of sea films, the sky burns out, or it's almost white, or, you know, I love to put it down to feel you're on a planet that's real and you've got a roof above your head. And I think I did that quite a lot in Radioactive as well. Sorry, you can hear that. Oh, I can't play that from somebody. We're just going. But that's basically how I work at the moment. And it's maybe a phase I'm going through. But I think it's because I think probably without sounding pretentious or anything, a little bit more in terms of painting than I do in terms of conventional cinematography perhaps. Who knows what would happen if I went to Greenland? Well, I don't know. But I love it. It's quite interesting. Like, off the cuff, I tell you, I love ceilings. I think that's an answer to it. I love a ceiling in a picture. Do you understand what I mean? And so I love to wrap it around the head of an actor or an actress. And I think it's quite interesting. That's why I love the high format. I love Academy format. I love the large sensor and a lot of headspace. I generally use a lot of headspace above actors, much more than many, many cinematographers. You know, it's just a matter of taste, but many cinematographers like to get in on the forehead in close-ups and, you know, bring the space down above the head. And a lot of directors comment on headspace. I work quite a lot with headspace.
Anthony, the last thing I was going to ask you is some of the nighttime street sequences. I got a little Road to Perdition, a little bit of The Third Man. Tell me a little bit about some of those nighttime Paris shots.
That's really serious take. It's Road to Perdition, Conrad Hall. He's the closest I've ever had to a mentor and a personal friend. Rest in peace. What a beautiful man and a master and a beautiful human being. So thank you for that. And, you know, I'll receive Orson Welles and Citizen Kane or whatever. So gladly. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'll put that. But, blimey. But, again, night, we're shooting in, Budapest, as you probably know, for Paris mostly. I decided on this film to push the sensitivity of the camera, because I was using the big sensor. So I could push quite fast and get texture, feed a little bit of atmosphere, a little bit of smoke in, and work a lot with fog in places, and just work a lot with atmosphere in night times. And what was at that time very important to remember, that you're in either gas-lit towns, you know, it's again in that epoch where we were just going from gas lights and old, you know, pre-Victorian systems of lighting to modern new systems of lighting. It was a very interesting time. All sorts of things were going on. So I think it really came from that, and I was looking for I like the counter colouring of like a slightly cyan green in the night work in this period film. I looked at painting as well, actually, it's not prompted, but I looked at Renoir and a lot of the French painters and some of the night paintings, and I just love those buildings, those high monarchic buildings, sort of vaguely playing out of focus in the background, you know, with mist and stuff like that. I think that's what, and I think the architecture of Budapest really inspired me. You just can't put too much focus on it because it looks like Hungary.
Yeah, you did a good job cheating that. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk, Anthony. I mean, it's a beautiful film, and I wish you the best of luck this Oscar season and in the future with what you're working on with Danny, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, well, look, thank you so much, man. It's lovely to talk to you about the film. It's very close to my heart, so I'm just pleased that people even talk about the film. It's beautiful, and I'm very fond of Marjane, so well done, and thank you very much indeed, and I'll try and do the best I can. And I'll watch out for those skies. I'll think of you next time I point the camera up in the sky and put a filter in.
Okay. Thanks, man. All right. Enjoy yourself.
Okay.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Will Mavity's interview with the cinematographer for Radioactive, Anthony Dodd-Mantle, here on the Next Best Picture podcast. You can subscribe to us anywhere where you subscribe to podcasts. We are proud to be part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. If you are feeling generous, head on over to Apple Podcasts. Rate us 5 stars, leave us a comment, and let us know what you think of the show. We really appreciate your feedback and your support, which you can also lend on over at Patreon. For $1 minimum a month, you will get exclusive podcast content from us. Radioactive is currently streaming on Amazon Prime, and it is for your consideration in all categories, including Best Cinematography. Thank you so much for listening, as always, and we shall see you all next time.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.